I won't apologize for taking up space in the world. I'm living large and I'm not gonna stop. My body sings and dances, and it's a tiger in the bedroom. And that's just some of why my fat body rocks.
Herzlich willkommen zum Larger Living Podcast, dein Podcast zum original intuitiven Essen nach Rash und Triboli, Health at Every Size, Body Image, Feminismus und einer Prise Ethnologie. Ich bin Dot und ich bin deine Wegweiserin raus aus dem Diätendschungel hin zu mehr Selbstakzeptanz, mehr Selbstvertrauen, gesunder Selbstfürsorge und Frieden mit dem Essen und deinem Körper. Lehn dich zurück, mach's dir gemütlich, schnapp dir ein Heißgetränk deiner Wahl. Wir legen los.
Hi, welcome Elise. Oh, big surprise. That is my very special guest today.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh my God. No. Thank you for making this possible. Like, this is honestly, this is a dream come true. To me, like, if 5 years back, Dot would have, if you would have told me 5 years back that one day I'm gonna interview all my sheroes for this podcast, I would not have believed you. Absolutely not. Well, I have to do a full disclosure kind of deal for the listeners and the viewers, maybe, and tell everyone that I might be a little bit biased today because you are my supervisor. I go to supervision with you.
Well, I like that bias. I think it's a great bias.
Who doesn't? So yeah, this is how I know you. And personally, I have known of you, of course, way longer than that. You and Evelyn have changed my life forever. You are the reason why I can get shit done now, because all of the brain space that used to be occupied with diet culture before is now free, and this is like the most amazing feeling ever, because I truly feel, and I want to give that back to all of my clients, to all of the listeners out there, that there is this freedom, like at the end of the rainbow or at the end of the road, in a way where, yes, there is a life without this. Yes, there is a life without you thinking about what to eat next, when to eat next, when you are allowed to do whatever. Also, like, there is a life beyond this comparing yourself to others also that is so fostered in diet culture as well.
And what makes me so sad, I'm sorry I'm breaking in, but
no,
what makes
please.
Me so sad is when I see so many amazing people, and I'm picking more women right now, who are accomplishing so much in the world, and yet they are still focused on their weight, on what they've eaten.
Oh my gosh.
Good and bad. I stood up at a dinner party one night with a group of friends, all of them very accomplished women, and four of them, all they could talk about was the weight they lost, how they have to lose 10 pounds. And I stood up and I said to them, every one of you is so amazing and doing so many wonderful things in the world. Why, please don't, you know, spend so much time? Why does that matter? Let it go. They listened to me for a moment. I don't know whether they changed or not.
Well, I hope they did. Well,
but I was thinking just what you were saying. I'm sorry, but there is some, one of them was an artist, and, you know, there's a doctor, a dentist, someone who works with seniors. And I'm thinking there's so many important things that they need to use their mind space, you know, to focus on, right? Exactly what you're saying. It's so sad.
That's exactly it. And the number of hours of time of that adds up to years of our lifespan, honestly, and the amount of money we spend on this bull crap, and on everything that is just crazy. And whenever whenever people come to me and say, for instance, oh yeah, but you know, intuitive eating counseling is so expensive. And I say, well, how much did you spend on diets before? Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to like push anyone into counseling or anything like that, like far from it, because honestly, I love the freedom of choosing my own clients. So do you, I presume. But yeah, it is also.
Well, here's the other thing. I mean, one may spend money on diets, but it doesn't help them dig into the deep parts of their lives at all. If they're spending money on intuitive eating counseling, it goes way beyond what food they put in their mouths. You know, it changes their lives, as you have said, changes their lives completely. And so it's a different kind of money that's spent also. And it ends up with freedom and trust and positive benefits, where the money they spend on dieting just ends up in feeling like a failure.
Yeah, over and over again.
Yes. Yes.
So true. So true. Well, for those of you who out there, listeners who haven't read Intuitive Eating, there it is. I put it up on the shelf next to the Intuitive Eating workbook. And here is the fourth edition of Intuitive Eating.
And it has now come out in audio version. So if somebody doesn't want to read it, and in the spring, it will be an actual, you know, CDs, but right now it's on Audible. So it's available now and will be even more available later.
Nice. And also tell me about the one book that I don't own yet. Unfortunately, I still have to get it. It is in the mail, is the Intuitive Eating Workbook for Teens that you wrote.
Yes.
And, I also wrote it down on my little cheat sheet of questions, and we're going to get to that. But at first, I want you to explain what intuitive eating is with this amazing new definition that you got after that horrible conference of this one person like bashing intuitive eating. And I used, when people asked me in German, oh, yeah, what are you doing? Like, oh, yeah, I'm doing intuitive eating. Oh, what is that? I said, well, that is kind of the going back to the time where you were a toddler and you had no food rules and the freedom that you experienced at that time. And I was always using that kind of little time travel definition, but yours is so much more accurate.
Well, thank you. And I will say briefly that the conflict was that the person who was bashing intuitive eating said, I looked in the dictionary for a definition of intuition and it said instinct. And we all know that we can't eat by instinct alone. And the truth is that's, you can't eat by only instinct because there's so many other factors. We have three parts of the brain that are functioning at all times. The most primitive survival part of the brain is called the reptilian brain. It's when the dinosaurs were there. And those dinosaurs, you know, they were out there, and when they got the urge to survive and eat, they'd grab a little dinosaur, maybe some herbs that were growing. But they didn't have feelings about it. They weren't scared to eat. They didn't have thoughts about it. You know, oh, I shouldn't have that. It's too many carbs, or it's not enough protein, or whatever. So a primitive survival part is in all humans as well. It's at the base of the, right at the brainstem, and it is the most, important, deep part of the brain to begin with. And then as animals evolved, mammals developed another level of brain functioning, which is called the mammalian or the limbic brain, which is the seat of emotions and social behaviors. So that sits on top of that instinctual matrix that the dinosaurs had. So now the mammals, higher level animals, had both of those, and information went back and forth from the instinctual part to the emotional part. And then what differentiates us as humans is that we have a third layer, which sits kind of on top and around the other two, and that's called the neocortex, or this is the part, the logical brain, the part of the brain that can think, the cognitive part. So getting back to mammals that aren't humans, they have feelings, they have instincts, they have feelings. If you have pets, I mean, when they're hungry, they go find food. they have feelings. I have known of people who've gone on vacation and their pets are really angry at them when they get back, yep. You know, and they'll act out, maybe pee in the bed or do something. But they don't have the ability to have cognitive thought to, you know, rationally think about what they're feeling or, you know, both instinctually and emotionally. So humans are then able to take that third part of the brain and monitor feelings and nurture, you know, feelings and make decisions that are to benefit the person. So this dynamic interplay of instinct, emotion, and thought is my favorite definition. It sounds like it's yours too, Dot, because it's a much more holistic approach to it. It's mind, body, soul kind of approach. So we want to take into, you know, account how are our feelings affecting our hunger? I mean, there's sometimes someone's in, you know, a place of releasing adrenaline because they're in a panicky state and that takes away their appetite, but they still need to eat, you know, or sometimes people have high stress like we have had in the United States the last week. And many people needed to comfort themselves with more food because their emotions were running so high. And so it may have differed from the simple instinct of hunger and fullness, but that's okay too. Sometimes Absolutely. We just need to comfort ourselves with food. So, Yes.
That was the definition I was looking for. Thank you so much, Elise, because I think it's just so nice because, you know, I think it's almost serendipitous that the logo for intuitive eating is three little kind of half moons or almost that have three different colors, and it's the three parts of the brain, and it's not just, you know, the happy toddler state that I always used as a definition. It's just makes so much sense.
Well, and there's another logo. If you look on my website, on my emails, it's three interchangeable circles that are connected. So yeah, it's three.
Yep. Makes a lot of sense. Okay, so now that we got the definition out of the way, let's talk about the Intuitive Eating Workbook for Teens. And my first question about this was, well, how is this different from intuitive eating or the Intuitive Eating Workbook?
Okay, so very interestingly, when the publisher asked Evelyn and me to write an intuitive eating workbook, he said at that point, after this is done, will you write one for teens? And my thought was, well, it won't be much different. Teens are almost adults, and kind of didn't answer the question. Well, when the workbook came out, he came right back and said, how about a workbook for teens? And when I started thinking about it, I thought, oh my goodness, it is completely different because teenagers are at a different developmental stage. They're kind of replicating that toddler stage. You mentioned toddlers before, but that stage where they're having to assert their autonomy or they're needing to individuate and separate from, you know, their families and be assertive. And so I thought to myself, I could write a book that is directed at actual teens and also at adults, because in my way of thinking, we carry that teen in us and that toddler in us our entire lives. So I have found that many of my adult clients have really benefited from the teen book because it brings them back to earlier times in their lives when everything got disconnected, you know, all of their signals were disconnected, and they're able to do a lot of healing. So it's really for all ages.
Lovely. Absolutely lovely. I just presume that thinking back to my toddler days and to toddler days in general with food, I happen to attract a certain sort of person in my life when it comes to eating. I am friends with a lot of picky eaters for whatever reason. Like most of them are male too, which it's also very interesting. They're all very nerdy, just because I'm a very nerdy individual. As you know, I love comic books. I love board games. I love video games. I love pen and paper role-playing games. And most of my friends from that friendship circles, they are very, very picky eaters. And I'm just presuming here that some of that might be addressed to like this rebellious state of, no, I'm not going to eat that.
Well, it's so interesting. Little kids will go through a stage after they've been eating for a year or two, and then they go through a stage where they don't want all the different foods. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly why, but if a parent honors that and doesn't try to push them, then they'll be able to ultimately come back to those flavors that they were, you know, liking even earlier. Mm-hmm. But if there's pressure, they're going to maintain that autonomous, you know, like no stage for a long time. I'll tell you a little anecdote. I have a step grandson who is 3, and his father and mother called me recently and said, we need help with his eating. Please help us. So I called them. I asked them a couple of questions. Is the doctor worried about his eating? Well, they said that he was a picky eater. I said, is the doctor worried about his growth? Oh no, he's growing great. He's just fine. And so I said, well, let's talk about what's going on there. And just as that happened, the little boy came toddling along and the father said, oh, we're talking about your eating. And the little boy said, I don't like to eat. And it was so telling to me, because already there's a struggle between the parents and they're pushing him just a few more bites. Just try this before you can have that. And what they've already started in him is a battle that he interprets in this as a 3-year-old as a negative thing. I don't like to eat, which actually isn't true. They told me there's many foods he does like to eat. There's just a lot he doesn't like to eat. So I think it's so critical at that early stage to honor even that tiny little person's taste buds at that moment and growth needs at that moment, and not get all panicked.
Absolutely. Just let it.
Provide the food, provide plenty of, a variety of things, including some things you know they'll like, and then step back and let them eat as much of it as they want or as little as they want. Absolutely. If they're growing, they're fine.
Yeah. Always keep presenting. That's what I tell my clients as well. Just always, always keep presenting.
Right.
Yeah.
Without pressure. Presenting without pressure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Here. This is also cool. You cannot see this, dear listeners. I have this light box for a while. And there used to be one saying that got me pushed me through university, that was progress, not perfection. But mm-hmm. I changed it into curiosity, not judgment, ever since I started training with you, because this is like really my intuitive eating mantra now. So, yeah.
Right. Yes, I think I developed that one a long time ago, Dot.
I love it. I just love it so much. Okay. Okay. How I'm going to segue to this, I don't know. I just drop it on you. Well, we in Germany, as well as in Russia, I presume, I listened to a few interviews with you prior to conducting this one, have a little, not so nice disposition when it comes to the book Intuitive Eating in German, to put it mildly.
Because of the terrible title.
It's not just a title. At the end of it, there is a translation that is not so so well done. That is a little bit, that makes it more diety than it actually is. It's in the last chapter, and the last chapter is, in my opinion, one of the most important ones. The last principle, you know, with the gentle nutrition. So the title in German is translated. Is called Intuitive Abnehmen, which is translated to Intuitive Weight Loss. Still is. And it's still getting published. And to this day, it's the 3rd edition even. So when people don't know so much English, they don't have a lot of alternatives than to buy this book. My colleagues and I, we call ourselves the Anti-Diet Club on social media. A few registered dietitian nutritionists, me as a life coach and as a cultural anthropologist, a social worker too, and some other life coaches as well. And so we still recommend the book, but we tell our clients, buy it used and put a big tape in on top of it and write eating and not weight loss. And we really have to do some briefing in order.
Well, one of the things I want to say in response to that is that, so that your listeners understand, we have no control. Once the book is sold from our publisher here, St. Martin's Press, once the book is bought by a foreign press, we lose all control. So we have no say over the translation, over the title, over the ending. And it's very upsetting. And it's actually, it's cruel. It's wrong. It's unfair. But we have no recourse. And now maybe the fourth edition translation, when it comes out, will be better. Let's hope. If it does, I don't know if they've made a deal yet with that. I know it's several other languages it's going to be translated into. I hope it's German as well.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed, like so tight, especially because the thing in Germany is that intuitive eating is well known, but because of this horrible, horrible title, there is a medical doctor who read, I think, the first or second edition of it, because in the third edition, there wasn't so much diet talk anymore. Mm-hmm. And she kind of took it and made it into her own and is selling it as a diet. She really is. And she's a best-selling author. She wrote two books by now. She had over 25,000 women go through her program in Germany, and this is what people associate with intuitive eating in Germany. They associate a diet, and we are there, and we have so much work to do in undoing this wrong and telling people, no, you have been duped, you have been fooled. This is not the original. This is why, for like every marketing advertisement material from me and also for my colleagues who have done the course, like, I'm not the only certified intuitive eating counselor in Germany. I'm one of three mm-hmm. people doing this. We all put on our website, we are the original, like in capital letters, mm-hmm. the original, in order to tell people, no, look, like we got trained by the source. I'm still in supervision with you. And you have been lied to.
Yeah. And I think it's even further misinterpreted because you said something about it, the first or second, the third is not as diety. It was never diety. What it was, there was a focus on eat intuitively and your body will find its natural weight. That was how. So it was more of it wasn't that you had to be less weight or more weight, or it was just kind of a focus on weight that we've completely taken out, but it wasn't from a diety standpoint. So then she's misinterpreting it even further because it was, you know, simply your body knows what it's meant to be, and through intuitive eating, it will find its place. But we don't even want, since the third edition, we haven't even wanted any mention of weight. So.
Yeah, like what she does is she uses very soft language in speaking of your feel good body and your feel good weight. This is how she sells this, and she has like no critical words about diet culture whatsoever. Mm. Like she doesn't even mention the term, and I think that if you subtract like the first principle from it,
right.
It is,
right.
You know, it's not the same.
So I'm so glad that you and your two other intuitive eating counselors are able to refute it. I mean, it's not, your voices aren't as big as her voice, obviously, but you just keep refuting it. And yes, I've gotten emails from people from Germany who are felt betrayed by reading it. And it's like, wait, this is not, the translation's all wrong. This is not what the intention was.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for making a statement for this. I would feel bad not asking you this. Another question I tend to ask all my interview partners is a little long-winded one, but I think it's I'm always long-winded, I know, but it's a very it's room for opportunity, I think, and I like that. So the question goes like this: what is a question or a topic that you get rarely asked, but that you are absolutely passionate about answering?
Rarely asked.
Think about that? Almost never, like really rarely up to never.
Well, rarely is someone aware of the oppression that diet culture presents to the world. So rarely does someone come to me and say, let's talk about, you know, weight bias, weight stigma, fat phobia as an oppression, because they haven't been enlightened to that yet. So I love to talk about that. And I actually don't think anyone has come to me. So that was a very good question, Dot, and actually presented it that way. But after doing this work and understanding the toxic nature of diet culture, the looking at the roots of fat phobia culturally, you know, the racist and patriarchal roots of it, white supremacist roots of it, then people's eyes are opened. You know, we can only know when we know. So much of this work is about opening people's eyes to things that they've never thought about. It's never occurred to them. They had no idea. And so I do love talking about that. And I will bring it up when people don't ask.
So. Great. Let's bring it up. Yeah. Let's talk about it. Especially because, I mean, Evelyn said one thing to me, and I think I should like letter this in the most beautiful calligraphy ever and hang it on my wall. Because I remember when I started this program in my class, in my cohort, there were only nutritionists. And I was the only one non-nutritionist, or just like one of two people who weren't. And I felt so out of place. I'm just like, okay, so I'm approved of doing this, but what is my role in this? Like, where's my little spot? And then I started supervision with Evelyn, and she, like in the first session, she said, no, you are the missing link. Because you know Margaret Mead, obviously, and you know the Fiji study, and you know all of that. And like diet culture is like we are fighting a cultural war against diet culture that is taking our joy, taking our time, taking everything, and oppressing fat people all around the world. By wanting to, I always do this with my clients, like wanting to press them into a narrow mold where their body doesn't naturally want to be in. And she said, in order to win a cultural war, you need a cultural anthropologist. And I was like, oh, I'm getting chills. Oh, my God. Me? Am I going to do this? I don't know. Who else is there? I don't know.
Well, diet culture has the word culture in it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And by the way, culture has the word cult in it.
So true.
So true. That's accidental, I think, but it is, that's what diet culture is all about.
I studied religious studies too. Just have to put it out
there. And I majored in anthropology. I don't know if I ever told you that, for quite a long time in college. I went back and forth between sociology and anthropology.
Oh, yeah. So. You told me this once. I remember. Yeah.
I love anthropology. It's wonderful.
Me too. Me too. Yes. It just humbles you so much, honestly.
Yes.
And it makes you, it really opens your eyes to the fact that we are all connected in a way.
Absolutely.
We all are. We all are human in a way. And there's like rituals and also images that span around the globe. I, for instance, wrote my bachelor's thesis on the image of the dragon. That is... Like in almost any culture, there is some image of a sort of lizard-like dragon, whatever. Yep. And it really opens your eyes. Same with food, of course. Like there's so many rituals around food and like which food is served for which festivities. Mostly pastry, weirdly. Like pastry is always associated with festivities all around the world, in a way.
Interesting. Well, in the Jewish culture, we have very specific foods for certain rituals.
Oh, I have to go eat kugel one day. I still want to.
And apples and honey for the new year, and challah on Shabbat, on the Sabbath, and different bagels and lox at the end of the high holidays. So, yeah, there's many of these wonderful cultural foods that go from generation to generation. Potato pancakes for Hanukkah. Mm-hmm. There's so many with applesauce and sour cream.
I'm getting hungry as we speak. I love apples. I always loved apples. And I also tell my clients a lot, like when they kind of lose it all, when they come to me and they're cereal dieters, and they're just like, yeah, but I don't know, like food is not fun for me at all. You don't understand. And I'm just like, well, remember the time we all have this one food that reminds us of the time that hopefully a loving person in our life prepared it for us when we were sad or when we were sick on or when we needed, you know, care. We hopefully all of us have this one specific food. And like if it's Pop-Tarts, it's fucking Pop-Tarts. I don't care. Right?
For me, it's peanut butter toast. My mother made me peanut butter toast every morning, and she'd say, don't you want me to make you something else? And I'd say, no, I love my peanut butter toast. And whenever I make peanut butter toast now, I look up and say, thanks, Mom, I'm having my peanut butter toast.
Same. I do the very same. Like whenever I make crepes, I'm half French, so crepes and waffles are like my thing. And crepes with a very special kind of brown sugar that my grandfather got because one of his friends was the owner of a sugar plant. So he got this like very dark caramelized sugar that we put on the crepes. Cassonade, my grandfather was Belgian. That really brings me back, and it's just when, and that's exactly it, like when we are anxious, like about the election or about COVID or whatever, like we have so much to be anxious about right now. Going back to that time by eating those foods is just so heavenly. Yes. Heavenly. It's, yeah, exactly,
connection, you know, it's connection, and it's
so,
and
true,
being able to think of that loving person, feel connected. Yes.
Right.
My grandmother made blintzes. Do you know what that is?
It's
like a crepe. It's a very thin batter, and inside is farmer cheese. And so she made the best blintzes in the entire town. And she prided herself on how thin the crepe part of it was, and oh my God, they were delicious. Yes. So it's a connection. It's a connection with that to my grandmother, with the peanut butter toast to my mother. I agree with you. I don't often think about this. I'm so glad you brought that up, Dot.
No, I just love to dwell on this. Yes. I think it's the cultural anthropology. Anthropologist in me, just because I also think of heritage, you know, like family recipes passed down from generation to generation to generation. And then along comes diet culture. And I listened to a podcast, like, I don't know, 2 years ago or something like that. And there was a podcast guest from Mexico. And she said, yeah, I've always loved beans and rice. I always have. And then comes diet culture, and like I'm there with the whole big family meeting, and I'm not quote unquote allowed to eat this because it's not according to my diet plan. Like, how devastating is that?
Sad. So sad.
Yeah.
So intuitive eating takes out all the judgment. And I have heard someone say, so it takes out the excitement, but I disagree. I think when there's no judgment and you're excited about being together with people and enjoying a meal or going to a new restaurant, or it is exciting. It's just that it's not that forbidden excitement. It's
a good point.
Nurturing excitement, you know, something that's going to feel really good and taste really good and make you happy.
So true. And I feel it's deeper.
Yeah,
because what I also always find, I'm not sure if you have to be familiar with Jean Kilborn, Killing Us Softly.
Of course. Oh, my goodness.
Right?
All of that advertising that is geared to affect our minds. Yes.
Yeah. And not in the latest installment, but in the one before, she had the ads from the 90s with the chocolate bars. And the chocolate bars were framed as almost like, I don't know, the forbidden little pleasures or whatever. Ooh. There's even one chocolate bar called Secret, I remember. I think it's still around, right?
I haven't seen it.
Yeah. And like your husband will never know. And then a picture of a crumbled chocolate bar paper on satin sheets like that. And I keep telling everyone, like, food shouldn't be sexy. Like, come on. It didn't give you an orgasm unless it's a sex toy. I don't know. But if just food, calm down. It's just like if you have this sexy thinking about a chocolate bar, you're putting it on a pedestal, mm-hmm. and you're making it into something more than it actually is.
Right. It's delicious and satisfying and yay, and you're done.
Exactly.
On to other things. Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And also, like, for me, like, sometimes I eat the whole thing, of course, but some other times I find half eaten muesli and chocolate bars in all of my purses now that are dried up.
I understand. Then they start to get melty if it's hot out, and the cloth in your purse is all full of chocolate. No, I have the same experience.
I know. And at first I was just like, what is happening to me? When I got that first, like, on my intuitive eating journey, now I'm just like, oh yeah, well, that's intuitive eating for you. There you go. Okay. Do I have another question for you? I think I do. Yeah, it goes back to the curiosity, not judgment thing, actually. And mm-hmm. I have found out something lately. It's actually a supervision question.
Kill two birds with one stone.
I think so. Via German, via effective. Yeah. And efficient. This is like entirely my guessing. I guess that 80% of my clients who come to me all share one thing, and that is an underlying anxiety.
Mm.
I feel, because also a thing that I've found out recently is when someone, and I make one hand that is open and one hand that is closed in a very tight fist, like very, very closely coiled. When they start releasing pressure on one side of their life, like, say, around food, anything like that, they're slowly opening up. Weirdly, like, this anxious, almost perfectionistic brain at one other part of their life closes off. So I have some clients who finally arrived at the point where they made peace with food and mm-hmm. conquered some of their fear foods. Maybe not all of them, but, you know, they're really making progress, and we're both like, oh, this is amazing, like, oh, the freedom. All of a sudden, diet culture puts on another guise, the guise of perfectionism, and bites them back in the ass at work. And all of a sudden, they can't let go of tasks. They're even controlling the tasks of their colleagues in order to be quote-unquote perfect, stuff like that. What are your words of wisdom on that?
Oh, well, I think there's a very clear explanation. So people, and I hope with compassion, will understand, self-compassion, mm-hmm. that the dieting and diet culture and worrying about weight and food has served a purpose for them. Yeah. It has been a coping mechanism to keep them away from dealing with some very deep-seated pain, trauma. And so when you lift all of this judgment around food, you're not lifting away all the original pain and trauma. And so it finds another way for some people, unless they're doing the equivalent work in therapy to deal with, you know, what's underneath it. So they have to find something else that will distract them from those feelings. And so it goes into being rigid, black and white, all or nothing, in other areas of their lives. So I think that's a very clear explanation for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so too. Definitely.
I think that can be used as a kind of a red flag of saying, okay, I've just transferred my way of numbing or pushing away my feelings into something else. And that's why often people who are sober from drugs or alcohol start to have eating disorders. I think it's just a way of signaling that there's more work to be done.
Yeah.
So that's my solution.
I think this is an amazing last word. So Elise, as a last word, please let the viewers and the listeners know where they can find you if they have more questions or if they want to reach out to you.
So I have my own personal website, which is EliseResch.com, that has a lot of information on that. And of course, there's the Intuitive Eating website, which is intuitiveeating.org. But if you really want to write to me, it's EliseResch@gmail.com. And you can write me an email there. And I also want to say I've got a new book coming out next year, which is The Intuitive Eating Journal.
Oh, yeah.
And it is your guided journey for nourishing a healthy relationship with food. And that'll be out June 1st. And on June 1st, Evelyn and I together did an intuitive eating deck of cards.
Yeah, about those. I'm so excited about those. 50
bite-sized ways to make peace with food.
Yep.
So two new things coming out. And then the following year, I did not write this book, but I consulted all the way through and wrote the foreword for a book on raising kids as intuitive eaters. And it's going to be phenomenal. That'll be in the beginning of 2022, a long time away. So
phenomenal. You have so much going on. Like congratulations. And thank you so much for taking the time.
You are so welcome. It's always a delight to talk to you, Dot.
Same here. Okay. Bye.
You may have noticed I am large. I can't hide it. It's no secret. It's a fact. I'm technically obese. I'm wobbly, jiggly, and round. In a word, quite frankly, I'm fat. The word fat can sometimes cause a bit of shock. Some people are offended, but I'm not. I've owned it and reclaimed it, and I'm not afraid to say it. I'm fat, and frankly, I rock. I won't apologize for taking up space in the world. I'm living large. My body sings and dances, and it's a tiger in the bedroom, and that's just some of why my fat body rocks. The war on obesity's a pile of shit. They just want to sell you one more diet book. They spend $650 billion round the world, so we're at war against the way that people look. Some people wanna clutch their pearls and worry about us. They should be dieting. Dear God, what about their health? But there's no correlation between health and my appearance, so you can keep your damned opinions to yourself. I won't apologize for taking up space in the world. I'm living large and I'm not gonna stop. My body sings and dances, and it's a tiger in the bedroom, and that's why my fat body rocks.